Welcome back to the Battle of Stalingrad podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. This is episode 14, and we'll focus on the events in the city starting from the second week of September 1942. By the 15th of September, as we heard last week, the fighting had intensified. That's as elements of the German 71st and 76th Divisions had been advancing in a wedge shape towards the central station, which it reached by midday. By 3:15 in the afternoon of that day, the waterworks were captured, and the Germans had reached the bank of the Volga in the south of the city. That meant the Russian 62nd Army was now cut off from the 64th. But, as I explained last episode, an NKVD battalion managed to retake the main train station, which had changed hands three times by the 16th of September. In the north of the city, there rose the strategically important Mamayev Hill, and it is here where the most powerful act performed by the Red Army in mid-September was recorded. The German 295th Infantry Division had fought its way to the far slope of the Mamayev Kurgan, and eventually it fell to the Germans. The struggle became intense for this hill. It was now completely unrecognizable from the park where lovers had strolled a few weeks before. The whole hillside had been churned and was now full of craters, similar to the images of the First World War. Both sides used these as instant trenches as the bitter fighting intensified. It was on the 15th of September that the Russians were to launch an aggressive counterattack to recapture the Kurgan. I'll use the Russian phrase from now on because it makes more sense. The Kurgan was 300 feet high, and from the heights, the German spotters could call in air and artillery strikes on ferries carrying Russian soldiers across the Volga, as well as Russian units within the city itself. It was crucial to control this part of Stalingrad. Unluckily for those called to fight on the Kurgan, it was also open ground with all the advantages held by the Germans. The Russians made their counterattack in broad daylight, running up the slopes of the hill towards a well-defended enemy position in the teeth of a devastating air and artillery bombardment. This could not possibly succeed. As General Chokov, the new commander of the 62nd Army, said, "We decided that we would hold on to the Mamayev Kurgan, whatever happened." Ivan Shalyev was artillery coordinator for the attack and watched the whole assault through his binoculars, and his comments were published by Michael Jones in his book Stalingrad, How the Red Army Triumphed. And here he set the record straight. "The story of how we captured the Kurgan is usually told incorrectly," said Shalyev, as Chokov was later to confuse two regiments in action at the time. Shalyev clarified the situation. The leading battalions of the 42nd Regiment crossed the river on the afternoon of the 14th of September and the remainder that same night, along with 34th Regiment. Their task was to erect a defence line in the central part of the town and stop the Germans from reaching the Volga, and it was a reconnaissance battalion from the 42nd Regiment which briefly recaptured the railway station during the night of the 14th. "But it was my own regiment, the 39th, which crossed the Volga 24 hours later during the night of 15 September and took up positions close to the Mamayev Kurgan, ready for an attack the following morning," said Chayev. They were going to experience some of the most extreme fighting ever recorded. Chokov was under no illusions how difficult it was going to be to launch an assault up a hill at defenders who could call on artillery and air defences. The general walked amongst the troops of the 39th Regiment before the attack, speaking simply to his men. "We have to retake the Mamayev Kurgan. Everything depends on it," he said. "If you're going to sell your lives, sell them dearly." The Russian troops he spoke to were under no illusion. Most would be dead by the end of the day. Chuikov's son Alexander spoke later about what this moment did to his father. He had seen the troops arrive at the base of the hill. He saw their faces and looked into their eyes. "They were strong guys, tough and handsome," Chuikov had told his son. "They were all readying themselves for the attack, and as I talked to them, I knew I was sending most of them to their death. Can you imagine what that felt like? And yet, there was no other way. We had to get the Kurgan back." So the attack was scheduled to start at 9 a.m. The Germans clearly had no idea of what was coming and had spent the early morning bombing the Red October factory in the city. They obviously could not see the build-up on their lower slopes. Back in the 39th, the first wave of soldiers began the attack at 0900. "Our troops approached the slopes of the Kurgan through a gully and were not spotted by the Germans," he said.
Then the enemy suddenly saw them and all hell broke loose. Everything seemed to go wrong at once.
The main reason was a lack of artillery support. The Russians only had a few pieces of light artillery on the western bank, including anti-tank guns and 120mm mortars. Most of the heavy guns were on the east bank in safety, and their supporting fire was way off the mark.
Then the so-called tank brigade arrived, explains Shalev.
He had a right to sound cynical. They had been expecting 50 tanks to assist their assault, but only 4 showed up, and worse, they were in terrible condition.
Within minutes, all of them had broken down on the slopes of the Kurgan. Shalev was disgusted. They could still shoot, but they couldn't move. Our tank force was supposed to support a massed infantry assault, but it was now completely immobilized.
It was then that German planes began to appear, bombing the assembled soldiers. The Russian strength was also reduced because reinforcements from the 112th Division were late. Eventually, they also pitched up, but instead of a full-strength regiment of several thousand, there were only 120. The delays were a disaster because the Germans were now aware of their opponent's intentions and brought the full force of their air power to bear. Heavy artillery and mortars joined in and began to pulverize the Russians, who were slowly making their way up the Kurgan. Vladimir Kiselyov was a company commander in one of the advancing battalions, and he said,
"It was as if we were hit by a tidal wave," he recalled. "There was a sudden deafening roar. Shells and bombs started exploding all around us. Many of our guys were killed or injured in that terrible bombardment. Our casualties were horrific.
The attack was on the verge of disintegration." It was now that another Russian hero made his timely appearance. General Alexander Radimtsev had arrived on the Kurgan. He had been watching the preparations for the assault and saw his soldiers faltering under withering German fire. He realized he needed to step in personally and somehow rally his men. It was near suicidal for a divisional commander to appear at the front line in such conditions, but Radimtsev disregarded the danger. It was an odd-looking general who appeared before his men. Ever since he'd set foot on the west bank of the Volga the day before, he'd been diving into shell craters to escape German bombs and artillery. His uniform now was filthy, but he was also known to be extremely humorous in the midst of attacks, and had the air of a student at the same time. He looked more like an intellectual than a Red Army general. He was 37 and already a hero of the Soviet Union. He was also one of those extremely few people who genuinely scorned danger. Radimtsev had survived the Spanish Civil War fighting alongside the Republicans, and more importantly was a hero to his troops. Many openly said their greatest fear was to be wounded and then moved to another unit. Radimtsev's appearance on Mamayev Kurgan added a desperate urgency to the counter-attack, and by disciplining the officers, who appeared fearful, he galvanized his troops, and the whole attacking force surged forward and charged towards the enemy. The Germans had dug a system of defenses on the summit of the Mamayev Kurgan and set up machine gun emplacements across the lip. They raked the attackers with a hail of bullets. One company was reduced from 120 strong to a dozen in a few minutes. The remaining men grouped together, flung their grenades, and jumped into the trenches. General Choikov was watching the assault through his binoculars and was stunned by what he saw.
"I will never forget their heroism," he told his son. "The enemy was pulverizing the hillside around them, yet they kept going, fixing bayonets and closing in for hand-to-hand fighting. I saw one of our soldiers bayonet a German and toss him up in the air."
These men were determined to take the hill. And watching through his binoculars, Shalev saw the violence.
"I saw the most savage fighting," he said.
The strain, however, was too much for some, and during the hand-to-hand fighting, they ran off in panic. Suddenly, a young lieutenant called Timofeev manhandled a captured German machine gun into position and turned it on the enemy, mowing them down with their own weapon. The men's spirits suddenly lifted. A guardsman hauled down the German flag and trampled on it. This was just after 11 a.m., and Choikov saw the red flag raised above the summit of the Kurgan, and word of this quickly spread throughout the army. The hoisting of the red flag was a gesture of heroic defiance. Stalingrad's defenders were determined to hold on to that hill. Later in the battle, they would be pushed off the summit again, but they remained entrenched on the slopes. Radimsev's guardsmen will then be replaced by the men of Goryshny's 95th Division and then Batyuk's 284th. But the Kurgan was never again surrendered to the enemy. It was not only symbolic, it was critical. Without that high ground, the Germans could not easily identify what was happening throughout the city. It was an eagle-eyed view. Regaining the Mame of Kurgan was a vital morale booster, but nothing could erase the fact. Conditions in the city were atrocious. The smell of burning and the stench of death were everywhere. It was an utterly disorientating landscape, with endless ruined houses, broken windows, rotting piles of rubbish that no one took away. Troops would return from an operation and find themselves lost before realizing that their shelter had been destroyed by an enemy bomb. Then an incongruous moment took place. As one group of men returned from Mamayev Kurgan, they passed two soldiers sitting in a courtyard. They had made a bonfire and somehow managed to find a frying pan, some flour and oil. They were making pancakes. All around them were heaps of dead bodies just lying there, because no one bothered to take them away. In the middle of this pile of corpses, the two shouted at the passing Soviet soldiers, "Hey, comrades, come and have some pancakes." On the Mamayev Kurgan, the dead were everywhere, and slowly, over the next 2 days, their bodies were trampled into the mud and the sludge. By the time the 95th Division took over from the 13th on the hill, a soldier called Nikolai Maznitska recalled the slopes of the Kurgan were completely covered in corpses. "In some places you had to move two or three bodies aside even just to lie down," he said. They quickly began to decompose, and the stench was appalling. Well, one thing kept the soldiers from going insane. Vodka. The vodka ration of 100 grams a day was vital and took the edge off the soldiers' tension. "Otherwise you'd go mad," said one. 100 grams was just enough to improve the mood, but not enough to dull the senses, which of course would be suicidal. Those who managed to pilfer or drink far more would find it fatal. "You lost your sense of danger and the ability to fight properly," said another soldier, speaking to Michael Jones later. Then it was about this time that a terrible incident would be recorded. Soldier Georgi Potansky never recovered from what he saw. Because citizens were caught in the middle, the Russian troops let women come from the part of the city occupied by the Germans to cross their lines and go down to the Volga. This little ritual took place every morning in September. Unfortunately, one of the women was spying for the Germans. The troop concentration points were concealed under the steep river embankment. There was no way the Germans could see where they were. These women could, as they scooped up the precious water. Later, after the citizens had returned to the city, the Germans opened up an artillery bombardment at precisely the points where the soldiers were concealed. A spy amongst the women had been busy, and successfully so. And yet, the next action by the Russian officers was to shock these hardened troops. When the women came down to the river as usual the next morning, they were all detained.
"Can you imagine what it was like to carry that out?" said one.
"The women were shouting and screaming at us, saying they had left their children behind, that their kids were thirsty. Many became absolutely hysterical. They were put under military escort and taken away by force."
What a shocking moment. These women were taken away for interrogation, but back at home, their children waited.
"We forced them to abandon their children. I still have nightmares about it," said one.
The Russians also had begun deploying a highly unusual company composed of dogs. The Red Army deployed a special team of dogs to recover the wounded. They were all trained to recognize the difference between a dead person and someone still alive, and worked in a pack. Some were harnessed to a sledge, and others were tasked with running about searching for the living. With not a human in sight, this team of strong dogs would locate the wounded, drag them by the uniforms to the sledge, pull them on, and then pull the sledge to a medical tent. This form of desperate ingenuity began, over time, to hold a deeper primal meaning. For many watching these moments, it appeared as though something magical was taking place. So as this battle developed over the next few days in September 1942, both sides were to realize it was an entirely new experience. German general, for example, Hans Dürr, described the very nature of fighting within a city.
"The time for conducting a large-scale operation was gone forever," he said. "The mile, as a measure of distance, was replaced by the yard. For every house, workshop, water tower, railway embankment, wall, cellar, and every pile of ruins, a bitter battle was waged."
Another German, Colonel Herbert Sell, who commanded the engineers detachment of the German 6th Army, recalled the horror of this kind of combat.
"Attack and defense, assault and counter-assault, constant burning, excited yelling, mortar, artillery fire, flamethrowers, Stalingrad became the living hell for which it is remembered. Rubble became fortresses, destroyed factories harbored deadly sharpshooters. Behind every lathe and every machine tool lurked sudden death. Every corner and every cranny threatened a sudden burst of automatic rifle fire.
Every foot of ground had to be literally torn from the defenders. Fighting inside cities is a very special kind of fighting. The recent Syrian uprising and civil war showed this, with the Islamic State fighters and Syrian army battling to control matters room by room, house by house, block by block. Those who fought in Stalingrad would agree. Things are settled here not by strength, but by skill, resourcefulness, and swiftness. The buildings in a city are like breakwaters. They break up enemy formations and make their forces go along the street. The strategy is clear. Hold the strong buildings that have not collapsed, despite massive air raids and hundreds of artillery shells. Each of these becomes a garrison capable of all-around fire if encircled. I witnessed this in South Africa during violent political confrontations in the early 90s, where multi-story residences turn into castles which can be defended. Yet the truth is, by the 15th and 16th September 1942, the Red Army barely held on in Stalingrad. The 14th, 15th and 16th September 1942 are 3 days where the results of the battle were actually dialed into history. It's just that those involved were unaware of this fact. On the German side, 6th Army Commander General Paulus and his inability to take a big chance was beginning to doom his men to the coming torture. His reliance on what he called method fighting, which worked well during a blitzkrieg, was now a weakness. His opponent, General Choikov, was thinking about what the Germans were doing and had the events on the 14th of September in mind when he said,
"During these days of fighting, it seems to me, Paulus had more than enough battalions with which to split the 62nd Army and reach the Volga."
And yet he failed. Yes, the 62nd had been cut off but not split. And yes, his divisions had reached the Volga, but they had been pushed back. Like a terrible ticking clock, the number of dead and wounded on the German side had weakened the formerly 250,000 strong army. It was contracting by the day. The Russians now had a chance to cling on, but it was a desperate chance, and the fighting in Stalingrad in September 1942 was truly horrific. The Russians were struggling to form a coherent defense line and trying to disrupt the cohesion of the German advance. For the Russians, southern Stalingrad was without doubt the most vulnerable part of the city. The Germans had already reached the river at Kuporoshnoye and could use this breakthrough as a lever, driving the defenders up against the Tsaritsa Gully and destroying them there. It was these gullies, which were found through the length of Stalingrad, that were the weak points for the Russians. They ran into the Volga from the western steppe and therefore allowed the enemy to penetrate their positions. The gullies were incredibly convenient for the Germans and offered something like a series of roads leading right down to the river. It was now that the most potent symbol of this catastrophic battle took on a new significance: the grain elevator. It dominated the skyline of the southern Stalingrad area. It was an easily recognizable landmark, and when Paulus planned a victory badge for his troops to celebrate the intended capture of the city, he used the grain elevator as his background motif. We'll return to the battles for the grain elevator next episode. But this must be said: it was to become the focal point for an heroic stand against the Germans. I'll explain next episode. Please rate the podcast on iTunes if you have the time. You can also contact me by email through the website abwarpodcast.com or direct message me on Twitter @DesLatham. Until we meet, goodbye.